From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The Republicans turned the floor of the House of Representatives into a let's make a deal set.
Questions are being raised about the CAFTA vote count as Congress narrowly approves the controversial trade pact. The battle over Supreme Court nominee John Roberts is heating up in Washington. We'll speak with Ralph Neese of People for the American Way and the Reverend Jesse Jackson. We'll also talk to Jackson about the right wing of the Democratic Party, the Democratic Leadership Council. Then the IRA orders an end to its armed campaign against the British government. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, resistance fighters killed two Marines with guns and rocket-propelled grenades in western Iraq. The attack was followed by a massive U.S. attack in the area with U.S. warplanes pounding the area with high-tech bombs. The Marine deaths brought the number of U.S. troop fatalities in Iraq this week to 10. In Baghdad, meanwhile, a car bomb exploded near a joint U.S.-Iraqi patrol. The Irish Republican Army formally ended its 30-year armed campaign against British rule in the north of Ireland on Thursday. While the leadership ordered its members to stand down militarily, the group did not say it's disbanding. The IRA says it will work with an independent arms decommissioning body to verify it had put its massive arsenal of guns and explosives beyond use, but gave no date for completion. We go to Sinn Féin's chief negotiator, Martin McGuinness. We'll do that in a minute, but Sinn Féin negotiator, we'll have more on that later in the program. The Israeli army revealed yesterday it's increasing its military and security system near the Gaza Strip in anticipation of next month's so-called withdrawal. The army describes a high-tech complex to ring the coastal strip with what Israel hopes will be the world's most impenetrable barrier. The barrier system will surround Gaza with fences, electronic sensors, watchtowers mounted with remote control, machine guns, and hundreds of video and night vision cameras. The Israeli military says the plan includes new army bases and 22-foot concrete walls around nearby Israeli settlements. Watchtowers armed with remote-controlled machine guns are to be built every 1.2 miles, and within a year, remote-controlled unmanned vehicles will begin patrolling the area. The barrier will run about 35 miles and will cost about $220 million. Israel says it'll be completed by mid-2006. A U.S. Army mechanic who refused to go to Iraq while he sought conscientious objector status was acquitted yesterday of desertion but found guilty of a lesser charge during his court-martial. Sergeant Kevin Benderman was sentenced to 15 months in prison on the charge of missing movement. He was also given a dishonorable discharge from the military and a reduction in rank to private. If he'd been found guilty of desertion, he would have faced 5 years in prison. Still, his sentence appears to be the harshest yet given to an Iraq war resister. In Brazil, almost all of the 6,000 residents of Gonzaga turned out to pay their respects to the young Brazilian emigrant killed by British police after the failed London bombings earlier this month. The body of Jean-Charles de Menezes arrived Thursday in Brazil, 6 days after he was shot dead in the head in a London subway. Many people in the funeral crowd wore black armbands and waved Brazilian flags, taken up as a protest symbol in Brazil since the killing. Meanwhile, Menezes' relatives are challenging the official version of the story. They say he was not wearing a heavy jacket that might have concealed a bomb and did not jump the ticket barrier when challenged by armed plainclothes police. Speaking at a news conference after a meeting with the Metropolitan Police, the man's cousin, Vivian Figueiredo, condemned the shoot-to-kill policy, which had led to her cousin's death, and vowed that what she called the crime would not go unpunished. She said, quote, "Although we're living in circumstances similar to a war, we should not be exterminated. Discriminating people unjustly." She spoke at a news conference with the family's lawyer, Gareth Pierce, and anti-war activist Bianca Jagger. The New York Times is reporting Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist is breaking with President Bush on the issue of stem cell research. The paper says Frist will support a bill to expand federal financing for embryonic stem cell research. Frist's support could push the bill closer to passage and force a confrontation with the White House, which is threatening to veto the measure. The New York Times obtained a copy of Frist's speech, which he delivers today. in it. Frist says, quote, while human embryonic stem cell research is still at a very early stage, the limitations put in place in 2001 will, over time, slow our ability to bring potential new treatments for certain diseases. Frist continues, quote, I believe the president's policy should be modified. The stem cell bill has passed the House, but it's stalled in the Senate. The move could also have implications for Frist's political future. The senator is widely considered a potential candidate for the presidency in 2008. A new report by the Government Accountability Office released yesterday shows millions of dollars designated for reconstruction and humanitarian projects in Iraq are being diverted for so-called security operations, draining money from efforts to rebuild water, electricity, and health networks. In many cases, security accounts for more than a third of the budget for individual projects, and the U.S. is paying individual security contractors up to $33,000 a month. That's nearly $400,000 a year per individual guard. In some cases, humanitarian projects were canceled to free up funds for security operations elsewhere. The State Department admitted Thursday President Bush's nominee for U.N. Ambassador John Bolton inaccurately told Congress he had not been interviewed or testified in any investigation over the past 5 years. Bolton was interviewed by the State Department Inspector General as part of a joint investigation with the Central Intelligence Agency related to alleged Iraqi attempts to buy uranium from Niger. When Bolton filled out a Senate questionnaire in connection with his nomination, Bolton said he didn't recall being interviewed. The response came after Senator Joseph Biden wrote to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice asserting Bolton had been interviewed and suggesting he had not been truthful in his questionnaire. For weeks, there's been speculation President Bush may try to appoint Bolton after the Senate goes into recess today, thus avoiding his nomination being defeated. This week, a U.S. District Court judge in Seattle sentenced Algerian Ahmed Rassam to 22 years in prison. Rassam was convicted of bringing bomb-making materials across the Canadian border December 1999 in an alleged plot to attack the Los Angeles International Airport. The judge, John Cunor, who was a Reagan appointee, used Rassam's sentencing as an opportunity to speak out against Bush administration policies. The judge said, quote, we did not need to use a secret military tribunal, detain the defendant indefinitely as an enemy combatant, or deny the defendant the right to counsel. He continued, the message to the world from today's sentencing is that our courts have not abandoned our commitment to the ideals that set our nation apart. The judge added that September 11th made Americans realize they're vulnerable to terrorism and that some believe, quote, this threat renders our Constitution obsolete. If that view is allowed to prevail, the terrorists have won, the judge said. Lawyers for imprisoned former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein say he has asked to meet former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who's a member of his defense team. They say they have received no response. Saddam's lawyers allege they're being systematically prevented from meeting with their client and preparing his defense. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of you out there in broadcast land and listening in on the Internet. Well, the battle over Supreme Court nominee John Roberts is heating up. In Washington, questions are being raised over Roberts' role in the civil rights debates of the 1980s. On Tuesday, the White House released 15,000 pages of documents stemming from Roberts' service as an attorney for the Reagan administration. The documents show that Roberts advocated a narrow interpretation of a variety of civil rights laws and presented a defense of congressional efforts to strip the Supreme Court of jurisdiction over busing, abortion, and school prayer cases.
Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy said Thursday the documents made public so far indicate Roberts holds a, quote, rather cramped view of the Voting Rights Act. Aides to Kennedy distributed materials that Roberts drafted while at the Justice Department and White House counsel's office during the Reagan administration. The documents show Roberts expressing criticism of an extension of the Voting Rights Act, support for a court ruling narrowing the civil rights requirements on colleges, and doubts about a law to combat discrimination in housing. Civil rights leaders are joining with Democrats who are calling on the White House to release more documents related to Roberts' work as a government lawyer. The White House says they'll refuse to release any of the documents from Roberts' tenure as Deputy Solicitor General under the first President Bush, describing the content of the papers as confidential legal advice. The White House and Senate Republicans are demanding a final confirmation vote before the Supreme Court begins its new term on October 3rd. We turn now to Ralph Neese, president of People for the American Way. He joins us from Washington, D.C. We're also joined on the telephone by the Reverend Jesse Jackson, founder of the Rainbow Push Coalition. Ralph Neese, we'll begin with you. Can you talk about what you understand now to be the record of Judge Roberts?
Good morning. From 1981 to 1993, the Reagan and Bush administrations did everything possible to turn back the clock on civil rights protections for women, for minorities, for people with disabilities, and older Americans. It looks more and more with every passing day and with every passing revelation that John Roberts was at the epicenter of all these efforts during the 1980s and early 1990s. The American people have a right to know precisely what his role was. According to the Washington Post and articles that they have written and others have written, it appears that he is even to the right of Ted Olson, one of the most arch-conservative lawyers in the country and in the Reagan-Bush administrations. If this is true, I think that the composite picture that the White House tried to create last week, which is somehow that this guy is an above-the-fray lawyer representing truly and clearly his clients, is not exactly what this man really is. This is someone who went and helped Jeb Bush in December and November of 2000. This is someone who is a leader in the Federalist Society. This is someone who looks like he was a partner with William Bradford Reynolds and all those radical right activists in the Reagan and Bush years. This is troubling. This is not someone who's in the mold of a Sandra Day O'Connor. This is looking more and more like someone who's in the mold of Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas. The American people have a right to have all of these documents. The Senate needs all of these documents to exercise responsibly its advice and consent responsibilities, but it looks like the Bush administration is going to stonewall.
We're all joined also by Reverend Jesse Jackson on the phone from Washington. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Reverend.
Good morning. Good to share with you today.
Could you tell us your immediate reaction to some of the documents that have come out already on the nomination of Judge Roberts?
Well, first of all, he is touted as being a very brilliant man with a good mind. Yet he forgot he was a member of the steering committee of the Federalist Society. That raised the question not of intelligence, but of integrity. He was counseling Reagan on how to maneuver not supporting Mrs. King on supporting the King Center in Atlanta, Georgia. His position on challenging women's right to self-determination as being unconstitutional is a very serious threat to the majority of our society. And the idea of not supporting voter rights extension, which today President Bush is not supporting voter rights extension. That's why we're going to have a major march in Atlanta, Georgia, August 6th, the 40th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, because so far this administration will not commit to voter reauthorization nor voter enforcement. So if he has that view of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, he is a very, very serious case of a velvet glove over a very right-wing iron fist.
Ralph, these also, the documents apparently indicate that in a 1982 Supreme Court decision that overturned the state of Texas law that denied children who were in the state illegal immigrant children from going to public schools. The Supreme Court overturned that, and apparently Judge Roberts criticized the Justice Department for failing to properly defend the state of Texas. Can you talk about that?
Certainly an unconscionable decision, and we are working with the Latino organizations across the country as well as other civil rights organizations, and I know Jesse feels very strongly about this issue. It's almost beyond comprehension that he could take such a position, just as it's almost beyond comprehension that someone who said, just after being nominated, that I get a lump in my throat as I walk up the steps to the Supreme Court, this same person goes to the right of Ted Olson and says that Congress has the right under the Constitution to strip the Supreme Court of jurisdiction over civil rights issues, over school prayer, and over abortion rights. This man, if these reports are true, has little respect for the rule of law, little respect for the Congress, and little respect for the Supreme Court.
Well, one, also, the right wing is against the Supreme Court until they take it over. They are for the Supreme Court if it rules 1857, the blacks have no rights, whites are bound to respect. They are for it if it supports 1896, Plessy v. Ferguson. They are against it if it supports the 54th Supreme Court decision. I mean, they believe in states' rights until it's time to intervene in Florida, of which Roberts was a part in 2000. So it's a really a kind of power grab, and they have cranced him out as this a clean slate, clean-cut guy with no agenda. He is at least as dangerous as Bork was.
Looking at an AP piece, these articles are coming out as these thousands of documents have been released. So the White House says they're not going to release any when he was anymore under Kenneth Starr, when he was Deputy Solicitor General in the first Bush administration. But it says, and this refers to Reverend Jesse Jackson talking about the 65 Voting Rights Act, Congress was considering an extension of the 65 Voting Rights Act against the backdrop of the Supreme Court ruling that held proof of intent was needed to demonstrate someone's rights had been violated. Following up on Juan's point, House Democrats sought legislation to change so election results would be sufficient. In a draft opinion article he sent to a county commissioner in San Antonio, Roberts wrote the proposal would not simply extend the existing and effective Voting Rights Act, but would dramatically change it. It's not broken, so there's no need to fix it. In other documents, Roberts, then working in the White House, wrote that legislation designed to overturn a different Supreme Court ruling would radically expand the civil rights laws to areas never before considered covered. He recommended against it. In a third, he wrote the administration could go slowly on housing legislation without fearing political damage. Ralph Neese, first, your response.
Number one, with respect to his tenure in his Solicitor General's office as the top political deputy, there are many precedents that support giving up such documents. Bork had to give up his documents when he was up in 1987 for the Supreme Court. Rehnquist had to give up documents when he was up for Chief Justice in 1986. There are many, many Democratic and Republican precedents. With respect to the Voting Rights Act, Jesse Jackson and I worked together many times, but especially in 1981 and 1982. The House of Representatives, by a vote of 389-24, rejected the opinions of John Roberts. The House by the Senate by a vote of 85-8. By the way, in 1985, the Senate Judiciary Committee, which was controlled by the Republicans, rejected the nomination of William Bradford Reynolds to be Associate Attorney General because he was defying the civil rights laws of the countries as passed by Congress and interpreted by the Supreme Court. John Roberts appears to have been the partner of William Bradford Reynolds during this time. I think the Senate should go back to those hearings in 1985, and perhaps we have an analogy here as to how the Senate should treat the confirmation of John Roberts to a much, much higher post, Supreme Court of the United States.
Let me hasten to say that while they decry activists on the court, we who feel the pain and the threat of this must ourselves become reactivated. And August the 6th is the 40th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And speaking of activism, when the Congressional Black Caucus met with President Bush and Congressman Jackson asked him would he extend the Voting Rights Act with enforcement provisions, he said, I don't support D.C. statehood. He said, that's not the question. Do you support the 65 Voting Rights Act with provisions of enforcement? He said, I don't know what you're talking about. When it gets to my desk, I will address it. Which is the Roberts position of not supporting it in the first place. It is in light of that, I must say quickly, in Georgia, they've reduced voting access ID from 18 down to 5. You can only use state-issued ID. So if you vote, if you're from Georgia Tech, you can use your ID to register. If you're from Emory or Morehouse, you cannot. There's private schools. My point is this kind of voter restriction, worker-suppressing ideology, it's what Roberts typifies. And that's why on March 6th, we're going to have a major march in Atlanta, Georgia, because we, the people, must take our case back to the streets. We can't just analyze, we must also act.
This is August 6th?
August the 6th, which is a Saturday. We'll gather at 8 a.m. in Atlanta, Georgia, and there'll be a major march. I might add that the Stevie Wonder and Willie Nelson and Roberta Flack and Darius Brooks, but the entire Congressional Black Caucus and Latino Caucus and LULAC and MALDEF and Council of La Raza and NAA and Urban League and SCLC, and Nancy Pelosi will be there. The AFL-CIO, both John Sweeney as well as Anna Stern will be there. Because we now sense that voter rights denial is and workers' depression is a big deal, and we cannot take it lightly nor academically. So I want those who are here today may hit us on our website at www.rainbowpush.org on our Atlanta office at 404-525.
Reverend Jackson, we're going to ask you to stay with us. We're going to go to break right now. But I did want to ask Ralph Neese a last question, which is how are you organizing? They're talking about the hearing being a month after the march that Reverend Jackson's talking about, the hearing, the nomination hearing being September 6th. How are you organizing it, People for the American Way?
Right now, we are trying to make sure those hearings are at a time when they're after the sufficient ample opportunity for the Senate Judiciary Committee members to go through these documents. The administration is slow walking, if not stonewalling, right now. So it looks like the hearings will be first week of September, but there may be more time required. With respect to People for, we've contacted all of our 750,000 members and activists across the country. We're doing internet organizing. We are in coalition in 20 states, the key 20 states, with moderate and conservative Republicans and Democrats. We're doing paid TV, radio, and print media starting this weekend. We're working very closely with about 125 organizations nationally and many more locally and regionally, asking the senators not to make a commitment until after the hearings, make sure all the documents are there for the American people, and make sure that the senators take their advice and consent responsibilities seriously.
Ralph Neese of People for the American Way, we want to thank you very much, and we're going to ask Reverend Jackson to stay on to talk for a moment about the Democratic Leadership Council. They just had a major meeting this past weekend. Then we'll talk about the CAFTA vote with Lori Garrett and with Lori Wallach, and then finally, Ed Maloney will join us to talk about the IRA saying they're laying down their arms. Stay with us.
Matter of fact.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We are broadcasting on over 350 stations around the country on NPR and Pacifica radio stations, low-power FM stations, on PBS stations and public access TV stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, also on DirecTV Channel 375. We're podcasting at democracynow.org, video and audio streaming, and our headlines are also translated into Spanish on our website, also in audio form as well as transcript, and you can take transcripts of any segment of the show from our website and pass them around. As we turn now to one of the major headlines of this week, Juan?
British military commanders are dismantling some bases and security posts in Northern Ireland. This follows an order from the Irish Republican Army Thursday for all of its volunteers to disarm, effectively ending a 36-year guerrilla campaign against the British government. The paramilitary group fought for the reunification of Ireland's 32 counties and to end British rule in Ireland. Over the past 36 years, sectarian fighting left over 3,600 people dead.
On Thursday, the IRA stated it remains fully committed to the goals of Irish unity and independence, and that the armed struggle was entirely legitimate. But the group said it would pursue its goals through political, not violent means. This is IRA spokesperson Seana Walsh.
The leadership of Ogie na hÉireann has formally ordered an end to the armed campaign. This will take effect from 4 p.m. this afternoon. All IRA units have been ordered to dump arms. All volunteers have been instructed to assist the development of purely political and democratic programs through exclusively peaceful means. Volunteers must not engage in any other activities whatsoever. We reiterate our view that the armed struggle was entirely legitimate. We are conscious that many people suffered in the conflict. There is a compelling imperative on all sides to build a just and lasting peace.
That was IRA spokesperson Seana Walsh. While unionist politicians in Northern Ireland expressed skepticism about the sincerity of the announcement, many other officials in Britain and Ireland praised the move as a potential turning point. This is British Prime Minister Tony Blair.
This may be the day when, finally, after all the false dawns and dashed hopes, peace replaced war, politics replaces terror on the island of Ireland. I welcome the statement of the IRA that ends its campaign. I welcome its clarity. I welcome the recognition that the only route to political change lies in exclusively peaceful and democratic means.
Meanwhile, Sinn Féin, the political arm of the IRA, called on the British government to fulfill its end of the Good Friday peace agreement that was signed in 1998. This is Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams.
And there's now no possible excuse for the British and Irish governments to not fully and faithfully implement the Good Friday agreement. In particular, this means an end to pandering to those unionists who are rejectionists. It means the British government must urgently address the issues of demilitarisation, equality, and the human rights agendas.
That was Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams speaking Thursday. British and Irish politicians are in talks to determine how to restore power sharing in the government of Northern Ireland. Initial measures will include amnesty for paramilitary fugitives and other measures enabling autonomous governance. In a minute, we're going to be joined by Ed Maloney. He's author of A Secret History of the IRA. But first, we're going back to Reverend Jesse Jackson to talk about the Democratic Leadership Council. Juan?
Yes. Early this week, the Democratic Leadership Council held its two-day annual convention in Columbus, Ohio. They outlined an agenda for the party based on national security, family values, health care, tax reform, and managing the federal government. Jesse Jackson, your response to the DLC's meeting.
I'm sorry, Amy. The Reverend had to go on the chair for C-SPAN. This is Butch Wing on his staff. But suffices to say that the DLC really emerged out of our rainbow presidential campaigns of 84 and 88, and in many ways were the antithesis of our southern progressive strategy in the electoral arena and for combining grassroots political organizing in the electoral sphere, and in many ways has taken credit for victories that others have won. So it again is raising its head, and we will have to challenge them again today as we did 10 years ago.
So you're saying you're, in a way, taking credit for the DLC, saying it was a direct response to this much more grassroots approach.
We're not taking credit for them. He emerged really in counter to us and the empowerment of African-Americans and Latinos and progressives around the country. And so it is time for us to rebuild and revitalize that coalition so that DLC politics do not dominate in the political sphere.
Well, thanks very much for being with us, and thanks for filling in for Reverend Jackson. As we turn now to the story of the IRA, what some are talking about, a farewell to arms, we're joined in our studio by Ed Maloney, author of The Secret History of the IRA, and former Northern Ireland editor for the Irish Times and Sunday Tribune. Welcome.
Thanks
for joining us.
My pleasure.
Your response to...
Well, in some ways, this is, you know, an exceedingly important move by the IRA because it underlines what has been a gradual movement away from revolutionary armed politics into constitutional politics. And with that has, you know, come the entrance of Sinn Féin into very much conventional middle-of-the-road politics. They've discarded a lot of their earlier revolutionary rhetoric and now very much sort of, I guess, mainstream, centrist, slightly left-of-center party. On the other hand, this is a move which is utterly meaningless. The IRA yesterday said that its campaign against Britain was now formally over. Well, there was no campaign against Britain, and there hasn't been a campaign against Britain really since 1997 when they called a ceasefire. And equally, the commitment to, from now on, to use exclusively peaceful methods is also meaningless because they signed up to that commitment when they joined the all-party talks, out of which came this power-sharing agreement, the Good Friday Agreement of 1998. So they're really formalizing the obvious and recognizing a reality which has been there for 8 years. And in that sense, it's absolutely cost-free for them. What they have not done, though, has been to do two things. First of all, give a commitment that the IRA will end another drift, which has been evident in the last few years or so, which is a drift into criminality. The IRA, which once fought the British and bombed British cities and so on and so forth, is now more intent on smuggling petrol across the Irish border, peddling counterfeit DVDs and CDs, a lot of them from China, selling stolen cigarettes around the doorways in places like West Belfast, running protection rackets, and so on and so forth. And if you look at the makeup of the current Army Council, it includes individuals who, from very poor working-class backgrounds, have become property moguls or millionaires. And how does that happen except through that? So there's no specific commitment that that will happen, nor is there any commitment that the IRA will go away, will disband, which was one of the demands that was made in the wake of the big robbery which took place in Belfast earlier this year, and also the stabbing to death of Robert McCartney. That was a demand that was made on this side of the Atlantic and also over in Ireland and Britain. There's nothing in the statement which suggests that will happen. And the suspicion, therefore, is that the IRA leadership, Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, will keep the IRA going as a sort of semi-criminal type organization which has the potential to cause instability to the peace process. And out of that instability, Sinn Féin builds electoral support. So this has become a story which is less about the achievement of Irish unity or Irish independence, and now is more really about, in my view at least, is it more about how Sinn Féin grows into a major political party, which is precisely what is happening.
And what about the prospects for the eventual success of the Republican movement in terms of ending British control over Ireland?
Well, my own view, and I think it's one that's shared quite widely, is that there is absolutely nothing in the power-sharing deal which could guarantee or even suggest that the goal of Irish unity is achievable. I mean, what Sinn Féin and the IRA have done by signing up to the Good Friday Agreement is to accept the constitutional status quo, that Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom, and that it will remain so as long as the majority of its population, that in other words, the Protestant presence or unionists of Northern Ireland say so. And of course, you know, given the demographics of Northern Ireland, that's going to be a reality for as far as one can see in the future. And in return for accepting the status quo and in return for accepting the so-called principle of consent, Sinn Féin has been offered, and presumably whenever this deal is revived, they will take seats in a power-sharing government. And become ministers. I mean, the last power-sharing government that survived for a couple of years, Martin McGuinness, who is now over here selling this deal, was Minister of Education, and he had another colleague who was Minister of Health. Those were cabinet posts. If you had said 20 years ago that these people who were out directing a bombing and shooting campaign to get rid of the British presence in Northern Ireland would have ended up as ministers of the Crown in the government of Northern Ireland, people would have thought you were mad. But this is exactly what has happened and is likely to happen again.
Do you think there's any relation between the timing of this announcement and what's going on in London around the bombings?
Probably not, although this is very welcome news for Tony Blair because he's under enormous pressure, as you know, in Britain. The view that the Islamic bombings in London of the last month or so, a direct response to Blair's role as the so-called pillion passenger to George Bush in Iraq, is very strong. And it's one that's very difficult for Tony Blair to deny, but he's been trying to deny it. He's under pressure. He needs some sort of success, given the fact that the Scotland Yard operation up to now has more resembled Keystone Cops in a very tragic way, as we saw with the death of that poor Brazilian guy, than an efficient anti-terrorist operation. He's desperate for a success on the terrorism front, and here's one which he can now tout around as a success and show the world that terrorism can be ended. And he, Tony Blair, has done this.
Pillion passenger, we've heard this a few times
yes.
now. What does it mean for an American audience?
Well, a pillion passenger is someone who sits behind the rider of a motorcyclist.
And what about the economic conditions in Northern Ireland? Clearly, Ireland has become a favorite for offshore manufacturing facilities from the United States, a tax haven in certain ways. What's been the economic conditioning developing in Northern Ireland?
Well, most of the so-called Celtic Tiger, which has been, as you say correctly, the result of investment in things like high-tech and computer, has been confined to the southern part of Ireland, the 26 counties, which has been independent from Britain since 1921. Very little of that has spilled across the northern part of the border. Really, conditions in the areas where Sinn Féin, for example, is the predominant party, have not changed that much since the start of the ceasefire. There's still a great deal of unemployment, a great deal of poverty. Housing conditions are not great. So there's a big gap to be made up there. And the ceasefire and the peace process, in terms of the economic condition of the ordinary people who supported the provost during the 30 years of war, they really haven't seen much of an economic peace dividend.
We're talking to Ed Maloney. He's author of The Secret History of the IRA. And this book is also a chronicle of the rise of Gerry Adams.
Yes.
And I want to ask you about Gerry Adams, the man, and what you think right now. But it's interesting, as we talk about sources being revealed, Juan was one of those reporters in 1999 who signed a letter on your behalf, Ed Maloney, when the British government attempted to force you to surrender your notes on a story you had written concerning allegations of state collusion in the murder of a Belfast lawyer. Can you explain what happened?
Well, first of all, I'm glad I'm here this morning because it gives me the opportunity to thank Juan in person for what he did for me, which was extremely valuable. And there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that if I hadn't got the support of people like Juan and indeed yourself, Amy, and other American journalists who rallied to my side at that time, I very possibly would have been in a situation very similar to Judith Miller. The story was quite simply about a loyalist paramilitary activist who had also been a police informer, who had given the police advance information about a planned murder of a well-known Belfast attorney called Pat Finucan. The police had failed to act on his intelligence, and indeed afterwards, when he also told the police about the movements of the murder weapon, the police did nothing at all. And these fed and fueled allegations and suggestions that the state had actually colluded in the murder of this attorney. Now, I interviewed this guy. He was very scared, very worried, and for the best part of 9 or 10 years, he did not want his story published, quite understandably. But then another inquiry was launched into that murder, and he was arrested, and he was charged with murder. Extraordinarily, the guy who had actually told the police that this is going to happen was charged with the murder. So at that point, he gave me permission to use the story, and we ran the story very heavily in the Sunday Tribune. Cause a great deal of publicity, and the next thing that happens is Scotland Yard is on my door with a writ demanding that I hand over all my notes of conversations and interviews with this man, presumably so that they could be used and I could be used as a witness in his trial for murder, and that I would not do and could not do. And we had a lengthy court battle, but also a battle outside the court in which both yourself and Juan joined in, thankfully. And we won that successfully. And it demonstrated to me, actually, one of the important things in a situation like this is, yeah, fighting in the courtroom is important, but fighting outside the courtroom is damn sight more important. And that's where you really win it. And that's not what is happening here, I'm afraid, with the Plamegate business.
Well, the way things are going, the climate in this country, we journalists here in the United States may soon need letters of support and solidarity from those of you in Europe and other countries.
Well, indeed, that's the way it's going.
Very briefly, if you could chronicle for us the journey of Gerry Adams.
Well, there's absolutely no doubt that Gerry Adams is up there in the pantheon of Irish Republican leaders. He's up there with Collins and Eamon de Valera. And when the history of this period is really written, you know, I think that will be truly recognized. And he's a man who was a leader and recognized as a leader with enormous potential from the very start of the Troubles. He joined the IRA when he was 16. His father had been in the IRA. When the Troubles broke out in 1969, 1970, he rose very quickly to the top of the IRA in Belfast. And he's been at the top of the IRA, either in the city itself or nationally, as a member of the Army Council, the ruling council of the IRA, for the best part of 30 years. Very charismatic figure. Very talented, a brilliant military strategist, but also a brilliant political strategist. And this peace process and this peace strategy, which was once described to me in terms of what it's achieved as the equivalent of turning the Titanic in a bathtub, is down to Gerry Adams. It was his plan, and it was his determination that pushed this through. And it required an enormous amount of skill, an enormous amount of ruthlessness, an enormous amount of duplicity on his part. The guy is no angel. This peace process involved sacrificing a lot of the sacred principles of Irish republicanism, and he did so in a way which preserved, A, his own life, but also delivered the bulk of his organization into this peace process. And that is why I think you see him lauded in the White House, that you see him praised by people like Tony Blair and the Irish government. They recognize that this guy has done something quite extraordinary for them as much as for anyone else, in the sense that he has brought these troubles in Northern Ireland, which were seen for so long as one of the intractable world conflicts on a par with the Middle East. It's now over. It really is now over. And it's down to Gerry Adams that this has happened. So, you know, like him or love him or loathe him, there's absolutely no doubt that Gerry Adams, you know, is an extraordinarily important figure in this story.
How did he betray the principles?
The ways are beyond number, Amy. The story is so complex and so dark so deep in terms of the things that he had to do. But for example, a book has just been published in Ireland, written by a former IRA prisoner called Richard O'Rourke, who was the number two IRA leader in the jail during the 1981 hunger strikes. And to remind your viewers, 10 IRA prisoners died on hunger strike for political status.
Bobby Sands.
This is Bobby, led by Bobby Sands, whose cellmate, Shauna Walsh, read the IRA statement that we just saw on the screen. Now, according to Richard O'Rourke, at a key point in the hunger strike, after the death of four prisoners, the British government made a secret deal or a secret offer to end the hunger strike, which would have given the prisoners 80% of their demands. And the prison leadership, including himself, accepted it. And the message was sent out to Gerry Adams as a representative of the IRA leadership that the prisoners wanted to accept this deal. And Adams overruled them. And the reason why Richard thinks that he and his colleagues in the jail were overruled was that if the hunger strike continued and more people died, then this would provide a platform from which Gerry Adams would be able to launch an electoral strategy to bring Sinn Féin into electoral politics. Without that extra sacrifice, it may not have been possible for that to have happened. As a result of going into electoral politics, we have the peace process. The peace process is a direct child of the hunger strike. Now, if Richard is right, it means essentially that Mrs. Thatcher killed four hunger strikers, but Gerry Adams killed six. And he killed six of his own colleagues, or he allowed six of his own colleagues to die in order to advance his political ambitions. Now, that's a pretty chilling accusation and allegation to make, and it's well supported by the evidence that Richard marshals in his book. And if it's true, and I suspect very strongly it's true, it gives an insight into a personality which is quite extraordinary, I think.
Well, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Ed Maloney, A Secret History of the IRA is the name of his book, former Northern Ireland editor of the Irish Times and Sunday Tribune. When we come back from break, we'll speak with Laurie Wallach about the CAFTA vote that just passed, or actually did it. Well, there's a whole controversy even over the vote count. Stay with us.
And thank you very much.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In a midnight vote, Congress narrowly approved the Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. The final vote, 217 to 215 in the House. The closest margin possible, as a tie vote would have blocked approval. Democratic Congressperson Marcy Kaptur said Thursday, quote, "Compared to the vote a decade ago on NAFTA, which carried by a margin of only 34 votes, this vote was even more razor-thin. It barely crawled across the finish line. To pass the agreement, the White House and GOP leaders had to overcome resistance from dozens of Republican members who opposed CAFTA because of issues ranging from the threat to the U.S. sugar industry to more general worries about the impact of global trade on U.S. jobs. To lobby wavering Republicans, President Bush made a rare visit to Capitol Hill, and Vice President Dick Cheney reportedly spent hours personally lobbying Congress members. Publicly, the Bush administration has been selling CAFTA as a national security issue rather than an economic issue. This is Scott McClellan, White House Press Secretary.
It helps to strengthen democracy in our own hemisphere. This goes right to our own national security. This is an agreement that will help extend peace and prosperity throughout the Western Hemisphere. While we're working to advance freedom abroad, we also need to be looking in our own hemisphere and make sure that we're supporting the democratic efforts that continue to advance in our own hemisphere.
That was White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. Meanwhile, critics of the trade pact have been blasting the last-minute maneuvering by GOP leaders determined to pass the agreement.
When official voting had ended in the House at 11:17 p.m., as the 15-minute voting period expired, legislators had actually voted to defeat CAFTA 180-175. But in an unusual move, the final House vote was held open for an extra 47 minutes, giving Republican leaders time to furiously round up holdouts in their own party until they had secured just enough to ensure approval. This is House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi.
What I said was that the Republicans turned the floor of the House of Representatives into a let's-make-a-deal set. It was reminiscent of what happened at the time of the Medicare prescription drug legislation that evening, and again, this time they kept the vote open a long time. But many of the overtures that were made to members was made before even going to the floor. So this is about, again, an abuse of power and an unethical way of passing legislation, and depending on what members decide to do, may require further attention.
That was California Congressmember Nancy Pelosi, Minority Leader of the House of Representatives, speaking on CNN. Meanwhile, a Republican who was absent during the vote would have prevented the pact from passing if he'd successfully cast a no vote. Republican Congressmember Charles Taylor of North Carolina said he thought he voted against the bill, but that a problem with the electronic voting system failed to record the vote. We're joined right now in Washington studio by Lori Wallach with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Welcome to Democracy Now, Lori.
Good morning. Can
you explain what took place? Start with that Taylor story.
Well, as you said, if the vote had been 217-217, CAFTA would have gone down. And, in fact, the vote probably really was 217-217, even after a year and a half of the White House pushing this NAFTA expansion, after the president was forced to make one of his first visits to Capitol Hill, literally in years, after Vice President Cheney set up shop literally off the floor of the Congress that night, with so much of the cabinet trolling the halls of Congress that looked like a cabinet meeting had become basically a roving craps game in the House of Representatives for the entire last week, after threats of cutting people off of committees, taking away all of their funding, after promises and luring and all of corporate America. What it came down to was ultimately, even with that, and for a trade agreement that for the U.S. is not very big economically of a deal, they had to make two people take a walk. And what happened was there, mysteriously, was the computer problem that did not record the no vote of Congressman Charlie Taylor, a guy from the Carolinas, said he voted no. Funny thing, they held the vote open for 62 minutes, and somehow, even though there is a stadium-sized scoreboard that has your name and either a green or a red light, Mr. Taylor didn't realize that his vote wasn't recorded, and no one found him for an entire hour plus to go fix that problem. Then there was a second member, Joanne Davis from Virginia, who claims she got stuck on her way back from the Boy Scout Jamboree. Now, the hitch on that one is the Boy Scout Jamboree event she was going to got canceled at 5, and this vote was at 11:30. And basically, you could go by yak between where it was and the Capitol and still be here for the vote if you'd intended to be there. Both of those members had agreed to vote no. And that doesn't even get, Amy, to the eight Republican members of Congress who are committed to voting no, when, as you heard, they stopped the clock. The leftover members were Republicans, and they sat there and browbeat people. They got two other people to switch votes. Then they let two of those Republicans vote against it. It was disgusting. I mean, when I hear Scott McClellan talk about CAFTA and democracy, it should be CAFTA, the cancer on democracy. Because when you see what happened in our Congress, when you saw in Guatemala, for instance, the military was called out to shoot at peaceful Mayans marching towards the Capitol to protest and murdered two people, the military called out against civilians in violation of the peace accords. I mean, it's just a perversion of democracy caused by this agreement before it even would go into effect. It's disgusting.
Well, Lori, while the administration says that this was really economically not that important, why then did it used such an immense pressure on fellow Republicans to pass it? I mean, clearly there have been a lot of defeats in recent years around this whole issue of free trade, beginning with, obviously, the World Trade Organization, the Free Trade Area of the Americas. There was, before that, the fast-track legislation was defeated. Why did they feel such a need to get something through?
Well, this is the good news and the bad news. The good news is CAFTA basically being truly of not that much economic significance, because all of six Central American countries in CAFTA's annual GNP together is about equivalent to the annual activity economically of New Haven, Connecticut. The reason why it became a very big deal was because symbolically it was like a referendum on the record of NAFTA. CAFTA was an expansion of NAFTA and that model. And in a way, it was a question about whether or not that model would have any viability. So this became a huge symbolic vote. The good news is that for an agreement that didn't really mean much economically, that it took that to sleaze it through, which they really actually, if you counted all the votes, didn't, bodes very well for the fact that the economically significant attempts to pursue that model further, like the hemisphere-wide NAFTA expansion called the Free Trade Area of the Americas, is toast, if that's what it took to get something like CAFTA through. The bad news is, for people in Central America, this is devastating, right? I mean, the provisions are very clear. People with HIV and AIDS who need medicine, who use generics, will die now because they will not get generic drugs, because this agreement takes away the ability to produce generic drugs. People in Central America who rely on essential public services, their drinking water, electricity, education, or, for instance, in Costa Rica, the whole telecommunications system, government-guaranteed access, has to be privatized and deregulated under this agreement. People's difficult lives will be made much harder. Or, as Oxfam and the World Bank reported, millions of Central American campesinos, small farmers, who are hanging on by their fingernails as it is, are going to get flattened by this agreement. And there are going to be millions of displaced and hungry people. Talk about instability. I mean, if it takes the military killing people to get the thing passed, and you know the results are going to be devastating, destabilizing economically and socially, as a national security matter, but as a human moral matter, what this is going to do in Central America is god-awful. And that is why, even though the vote has happened, there's one more action for people of justice in the U.S., and that is to call the members of Congress, because there are a lot of them, despite all this beating, who did the right thing, and thank them, and keep them buoyed up and ready to fight on the next agreements, because there's been incredible momentum, public education, new people brought to the fight for the future of finally boxing and bearing this failed model. But for those members of Congress who voted wrong, they need to feel it 24/7. We can't let the calls go away once the vote happens. If they voted wrong, they need to get three times more calls. And come election time, the job that needs to be lost is theirs. And there's some people on whom we can do that. That's how we win. That's how we take the work that was done and the momentum on this vote, and we turn it into a real, honest vote victory. Because if you think of what they had to do, and the fact, really, if all the people had voted, we would have won, it actually bodes well for our future, even though it's horrific for what it's going to do in Central America.
And, Lori, I understand one report I read said that the pharmaceutical companies got greater protection against generic drugs in this legislation than they have already in the United States.
That's true, and it's a god-awful provision. It, literally, the rule is, under CAFTA, every country has to modify all of their domestic laws to meet CAFTA's rules. And CAFTA's rule is that a generic drug company is not allowed to get access to the data that the brand name company used, the testing data to prove safety and efficacy, so that the generic company would theoretically have to do all of the studies over. Now, of course, that's where the saving is. And typically, a generic company uses the information, the testing data that's used to get the marketing approval, the right to sell the drug in the country, to get their own marketing approval.
Lori, we have 5 seconds.
That's now made a monopoly.
Lori Wallach, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Public Citizens Global Trade Watch is her organization. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdokadoush, John Hamilton, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Our website is democracynow.org. You can go there for our headlines and our transcripts. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.